This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the next big thing in anti-inflammatory supplements, a brand new all-natural daily preventative against a host of possible inflammatory issues. Black for Health liquid extract from Future Farm Botanicals. Black for Health combines four plant-based foods, black garlic, black radish root, black cumin seed, and black peppercorn, containing high levels of body-ready healing botanicals. Black for Health supports your liver, skin, cholesterol, blood pressure, and weight management, circulation, and immunity. It's a tasty supplement with liposome complex for optimal absorption. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's myfuture, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're going to talk about what else? The elephant in the room, COVID-19. Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? We're going to talk to an expert. He's across the pond in the UK. The situation there is kind of fluid because it appears that the Parliament in the UK has authorized a renewal of something kind of draconian sounding, the Coronavirus Act, that they say is still needed to keep people safe. It's a series of measures, including lockdowns, that are highly controversial over there in the UK. And there's sporadic outbreaks of coronavirus, especially in countries like Belgium, creating a good deal of consternation. Are we going to be having a second wave? Today, we're going to talk to Dr. Robert Verkerk. He is a PhD and founder and executive and scientific director of something called the Alliance for Natural Health International. It's the international version of a group that I belong to here in the United States, ANH, Alliance for Natural Health. Dr. Verkerk is also instrumental in the stateside version of this organization. He's acted as its founder, executive, and scientific director since 2002. And he is a true Renaissance man because he's authored some 60 papers in scientific journals. He's frequently called upon to speak to scientific and lay audiences about topics in science. And he has been all over this COVID-19 crisis. So, Rob, it's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us again.
Hey, Ron. Fantastic to talk to you again.
Okay.
Great to hear you got the news about the parliamentary defeat. This is democracy not in progress. It was essentially 330 against 24. So 330 parliamentarians, obviously all of those being conservatives, going with the government to extend the Coronavirus Act for another 6 months.
Mm-hmm. So there is controversy over there about how to handle this. There's the sort of the lockdown stalwarts versus the, shall we say, the let it rip proponents, people who are more supportive of kind of a Swedish model of rather laissez-faire when it comes to social distancing. And so, I mean, I guess some of these measures still need to be in place, even in a country like Sweden. But some people believe that we should liberalize this measure. What say you?
Well, essentially in the UK, we've seen 2 weeks of demonstrations in London around the Nelson's Column in Trafalgar Square, around about 35,000 people demonstrating against the lockdown. There is a view that's supported by an increasingly powerful group of scientists, of which I'm a part, that says the action, the policy action on coronavirus is disproportionate. It doesn't compare with what we're doing with any other disease. Currently, if you look at the mortality levels caused, or in fact, we don't know conclusively, as you will know, the direct relationship between COVID or coronavirus as a cause of deaths related to COVID, but it's currently sitting about 24th in the list of sources of mortality, even when you just look at cases of death where COVID is associated.
So, to reiterate, what you're saying is that people are dying and they may test COVID positive, but what you're saying is that the proximate cause of their deaths is not COVID-19, although their death certificates might list that. Is that what your argument is?
Yeah. What we've seen is on the 12th of August, the UK government did change the criteria on which a death would be considered to be involved with COVID. And essentially, if you have a positive test, an antigen test, an RT-PCR test, within 28 days of your death, it's considered a COVID death. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the same if you have a motor car accident. Worldwide, we have those kinds of problems because pathology services have been on a go slow ever since lockdown occurred. So it's pretty difficult to get to the bottom of what may have caused it. But we could be doing a better job, I think, in all countries. However, if you consider that the measure is roughly the same, we've got to take stock of, is there a change in the number of COVID cases? Is there a change in hospitalization rates? Right. Is there a change in mortality? And obviously, you will see cases probably by roughly a 28-day, 1 month lag to hospitalizations, which in turn may be another 1 month lag to mortality. Mm-hmm. But we are starting to see a change in numbers on the official stats. And the question is, how much of this is real? How much of this may be an anomaly of the statistics? And I think I have picked up, and we have published a story which I think caught your interest, Ron, on the way in which Bayesian statistics can have an influence on the number of true versus false positives. And it does appear that there is some noise in the statistics that we're seeing that are created by both increasing test frequency and the effect of people being alarmed by, having higher levels of positive tests when in fact many of these could be false positives. And it, has a big bearing if you're suddenly told you've got to self-isolate, as we are in the UK. If you have a positive test, you have to self-isolate for 14 days. That's having a big impact on everyone from students to employed people, families, social interaction, et cetera, et cetera.
And in fact, you've coined a term for this, which is case-edemic, which is the notion that maybe we are seeing an uptick in officially designated cases, but that may not reflect the reality on the ground or the potential threat of a second or third wave.
Well, Ron, you can look at a number of countries, including the UK and increasingly the United States, and you can see that from a daily case rate, you can go onto the Johns Hopkins sites and look at these data yourself, and you'll see that what is happening in many countries now, the number of cases is achieving the same level on the y-axis as we had basically at the peak of the problem when people were dying in significant numbers in hospitals. Yet we have
and that is a scary prospect. I mean, we're saying, oh my goodness, all these cases, outbreaks in certain hot spots and so on, and that's causing people to rethink the reopening of the economy. Bringing people back to school and university, and opening up restaurants and sports events and so on.
Exactly, and of course, the problem back then is that the tests were at the early stage of development. A lot of emergency units were actually trying desperately to keep people alive. And it was pretty obvious they had this new disease that was behaving in a different way from regular pneumonia. So as a result, we had a lower testing frequency. What's happened since is we have much less overt COVID disease. We have change the narrative, the kind of narrative that you get through the mainstream media on your evening news. We're no longer hearing so much about hospitalizations and deaths. We're hearing about numbers of cases. And And of course, if you test more and more people, the numbers will start going up. And then you have this complicated statistical problem that occurs, that when you test people with any diagnostic or screening test, where the what we consider in Bayesian terms the pretest probability, the amount of disease that's around that affects that the ability to predict the accuracy of that test once you have it, we know very well that when the prevalence is low at the kind of levels that we have in many parts of the Western world at the moment, below 1%, 0.05% even, the Bayesian statistics basically tells us that the likelihood that the test will be correct is very, very low. In fact, the accuracy can drop down. If you have a 95% specificity of your test in the real world, mm-hmm. which can be a claimed 98% that drops a little bit because of
the and that's a pretty good test. 95% 90. You'd say that's a good test. You know, that sounds good.
Yeah, so you can if you use a Bayesian formula, you'll discover that if you have a 95% specificity, you will at 0.05% have a probability that's around about 2%, maybe less. And you know, to try and understand this, since we published the article, we've had so many people asking about it. I think I've mastered the art of explaining.
Great.
This
because it's counterintuitive. It really is counterintuitive. People think, look, it's a test. It's accurate, you know. And if I'm positive, it's got to be positive because it's such an accurate test.
Okay, so imagine your RT-PCR test that's basically designed to look for a very specific sequence.
That's a nasal swab.
Genetic sequence, yeah, from a nasopharyngeal swab. So you test it and your PCR is amplifying that gene sequence. It does so most of the time really accurately, but every now and then it makes a mistake, and that error level is 5%, which gives us our 95% specificity. Now, mm-hmm. the specificity as measured in a lab, and you may see that, you know, Roche or Abbott may quote a higher level, but that is under perfect conditions. Mm-hmm. So sometimes they will quote 98%, sometimes even 100%. But we know from lots of research that when you move to the field, it drops several percent. Mm-hmm. And in fact, some of the levels may be lower than 90%. So 95% is a pretty conservative estimate. Mm-hmm. So if you imagine you're looking for a needle in a haystack, and that your PCR test is designed to find real needles. Mm-hmm. If you have a small haystack, in other words, the needle is in a small population that is highly exposed to the disease, or mm-hmm. in this case, the virus, mm-hmm. it is less likely to find things that look almost like the real needle. Whereas if you have that one needle in a very large haystack, in other words, disease prevalence or virus prevalence low, it will be more likely to find bits of straw that look a little bit like the needle it's looking for. Mm-hmm. So the result is, if you get, as one of those people who gets the positive test, you could have had that bit of genetic material that was from another virus, for example, that looked a bit like the real thing but isn't quite. So the probability of your test being a true positive drops. Mm-hmm. And the fascinating thing is that the CDC and the FDA know this, because you can go on to the CDC website and find yourself the, essentially the FDA calculator as published by the CDC specifically relating to antibody tests. Now, they do that for antibody tests, they're less used. But mm-hmm. the principle of this Bayesian effect, remember that Thomas Bayes was, basically published this theorem back in 1763. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really until the 1950s that its relevance to diagnostic and screening tests was picked up by the medical community, particularly because you could, you know, run this through computer programs. But it has now a huge influence. And essentially what should be happening is that everyone who gets the test could be given a probability of the likelihood of that test being accurate. It's exactly what we do with a weather forecast. Mm-hmm. You know, if you see they use...
It's not an absolute. It's not a binary thing.
It's not
thing.
An absolute.
Right.
So you can see that rain cloud that may have no drop of rain underneath mm-hmm. it. But when you mm-hmm. look at the detail, you'll see that there's still a 10 or 12% mm-hmm. probability of rain mm-hmm. because we've got enough information. So frankly, because the amount of virus is so low in so many parts of the world now, we know that the probability of it being a false negative can be over 90%. A false positive mm. Could be over 90%.
Mm.
So
that's incredible.
We should be the public should be being told about this.
You know, so one of the ways that I have explained this is, you know, in the days when HIV was a big concern, we would have patients and I'd say, well, I'm going to do a routine blood test on you, and they would say, can I please get an HIV test? And I'd say, well, have you been involved in any risky behaviors? Are you sexually active with multiple partners, et cetera? And some people would say, no, you know, I'm in a monogamous relationship. I was a virgin when I met my husband or my wife, and that they've been my sole sexual partner, and they don't stray. And I would say, please don't get the test. And they'd say, well, why? I just want to make sure that I'm not HIV positive. And I say, look, it is so unlikely that you have been exposed to HIV that because even though the test is 99% accurate, and I was conscious of Bayes' theorem then, I said that if you get a positive, A, it's going to freak you out, and B, it's a very high likelihood of being a false positive. And it's a little bit like that when we just sort of screen people. You know, people come in voluntarily, you know, maybe they're on a sports team, or maybe they, you know, they're in college, or maybe their job requires them to be tested. And it's very unlikely that they have been exposed. And they turn out positive because of Bayes' theorem. It's
100%. That's exactly what's going on. And of course, Carrie Mullis was very hot on that. The biochemist who developed PCR was very hot on that exact subject in relation to HIV. And of course, sadly, he passed away in August, last August. So didn't see what has happened over the last 6-7 months or 9 months, is mm-hmm. it now? And he would have been saying exactly that, no doubt. But because he was a surfer and a bit of a crazy dude, not everyone would have been listening to him.
Right.
But, yeah.
Eccentric scientist.
He knew the score. Exactly.
So I've read that it's also possible that, you know, what they're doing is they're not testing for the virus per se. They're not like putting the virus in a petri dish or something and trying to culture it. They're actually testing for a genetic sequence. And it's a partial genetic sequence. I don't believe it's the entire genetic sequence. And that there's a homology or a similarity between certain things that float around in the body anyway, you scraps of DNA, and the coronavirus, or maybe, you know, other pathogens that can trigger a positive outcome. Is that part of this?
That's absolutely right. The key primer that's being used is a membrane protein. So you'll be aware that for the vaccines, what they're doing is effectively using a sequence to prime, particularly the antibody to a degree, the T cell response, based on the spike protein. In terms of the antigen test, the PCR test, it is primarily a sequence from the membrane protein. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right that the reality is that there is a soup of these gene sequences. You know, our virome is something that we're only just coming to terms with understanding. Mm-hmm. And there is a soup of these things. We know that we're exposed to 6 or 7 other coronaviruses. There may be many more because we're coming to terms with the fact that coronaviruses are pretty common. The vast majority of them don't create any illness at all. And of course, we've had the SARS and MERS that are the two that are more pathogenic, as is now SARS coronavirus 2. But yes, there is a soup there. We're looking for a sequence. Mm-hmm. So it's not like doing an HPLC test for a chemical mm-hmm. in your bloodstream, for example.
Which is a very distinctive fingerprint that is irreproducible.
Yeah, you're looking for the entire molecule. Mm-hmm. You're looking for that entire molecule. Mm-hmm. Here, you're only looking at a tiny fraction of a gene sequence mm-hmm. belonging to something that isn't a living organism that we call a virus. The problem from a diagnostic point of view is that there is no gold standard. So typically we would have had a gold standard that also related the test to a disease. And this time what we're actually chasing is not a disease at all, which of course puts a big question mark over whether or not we genuinely in scientific terms are dealing with a pandemic. We everything that's happening at the moment fits with the WHO pandemic definition, but it does not fit with pandemics that have occurred historically, because pandemics that have occurred historically typically, have a disproportionate impact on younger people. And if they do, they have more of an impact on health span and lifespan.
Like the 1918 flu, the classic, Spanish flu.
Yeah. Correct. So this one does not have that pattern. It is primarily taking out people who are old and people who have multiple comorbidities, as we all are very well aware of.
Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share this vital information with you. Naturally occurring black pigments in vegetables, spices, and seeds have been found to have powerful anti-inflammatory effects. Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I'm excited about what I think may be the next big thing in anti-inflammatory supplements, a brand new, all-natural daily preventative against a host of possible inflammatory issues. Black for Health liquid extract from Future Farm Botanicals. Black for Health combines four plant-based foods, black garlic, black radish root, black cumin seed, and black peppercorn, containing high levels of body-ready healing botanicals. Black for Health supports your liver, skin, cholesterol, blood pressure, and weight management, circulation, and immunity. It's a tasty supplement with a liposome complex for optimal absorption. For more information, order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's myfuturefarm. Farm, PHARM, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make intelligent medicine a continuing free resource to you. And now back to our guest, Dr. Robert Furkirk. So the other thing is that they're using rapid diagnostic tests, and those have in some celebrated cases, have indicated that people are positive. And then upon subsequent retesting, and, especially where the stakes are high, they've done, this with some athletic teams, and they thought, well, look, we're going to have to scotch the whole season here or take the team out of competition. And then they do a more precise test, which in this case is the PCR, oropharyngeal swab. And then they say, oh, that was a false positive. And the rapid test is very convenient because you get instantaneous results within like 15 minutes, a point of care testing, you put it into a doctor's office or a school or a hospital emergency room. Those are worse. Those are actually less good, right?
Well, there are two things going on. First of all, if you look at the problem with having additional false negatives, which is really the other key parameter mm-hmm. that is claimed for these tests, is the sensitivity. The sensitivity and the specificity for some of the rapid tests are claimed by manufacturers as being pretty high. Some of them, 99%, even 100%. So the difficulty is because we have no gold standard and because you are reliant on a fairly closed loop between the medical device manufacturer and the regulator, such as the FDA, we have to go along and accept these numbers. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing. You would imagine that they should be lower than a PCR test, but we really don't know. And thirdly, if you have repeat tests, because of probability theory, if you keep testing yourself, you will probably be more likely to get a true result over time. So, mm-hmm. You've got
best 2 out of 3, best 3 out of 5.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So the bottom line is that what we would be saying, if you are relatively unsure how you might be exposed, and that pretty much applies to anyone in the community who's not working in an emergency unit, you know, with very high viral loads. If you get a positive result, the very least you should do is have a retest.
Yeah. Which in some cases has vindicated people. I mean, there was one guy, I think he was a governor. He was supposed to be meeting with President Trump on the campaign trail, and he tested positive with one of these rapid tests. And then they sent him to, Bethesda Naval Hospital or Johns Hopkins or, you know, some highfalutin place. And they said, man, you're okay. You're testing negative. So, and this has happened multiple times.
Absolutely. So I mean, the problem is if you have a very low probability, you know, if you look at the predictive positive value as, you know, the work here in terms of bringing Bayes' theorem into diagnostics was done by Professor Doug Altman at Oxford University. He published a landmark, actually a very short, concise paper because all his work was done elsewhere, but where he applied Bayes' theorem to diagnostic testing and basically said, guys, don't even bother, because once you use the full Bayesian formula, you will find that where you have very low disease prevalence, your false positive rate goes through the roof. And that's what's not being used. And in many cases, even, you know, Doug Altman's PPV, predictive positive value, that's quoted is using a simplified version of the formula that actually understates the problem with false positives.
Mm-hmm. So the bottom line, I mean, look, we don't want to be in COVID-19 denialism. We don't want to say that, you know, it's all concocted or that there's, you know, minimal threat to human health. But on the other hand, your op-ed entitled Casedemic, which, by the way, you can tell people where they can find it because, you know, you're a great resource on this subject.
Absolutely. It's, if you go to our website at anhinternational.org, you'll see it. It's on the homepage. But if you want to dive into our campaign section, you'll see our Adapt, Don't Fight campaign, which has basically a huge number of articles and analysis and scientific updates around COVID. There's a lot of information there, plus a lot of videos.
So you're not into COVID-19 denialism, but you're arguing for a more nuanced approach to this, an approach which balances public safety and health versus the enormous downsides of, you know, the lockdown, the social isolation, the hit to our economy, the adverse effects on our healthcare system when we devote disproportionate resources to COVID-19 and ignore other health problems. I think that's the thrust of your argument. Okay,
just briefly, yeah. What we need to be looking at on tests is if we keep an eye on a thing called the positivity rate, which is the number of positive tests from your tested population, you get a really good handle on where things are at. And in the US, you can actually, the CDC is keeping a count on that. And you can see right now about 25% of states are sitting over the 5% threshold. Essentially, the World Health Organization said back on the 12th of May, if the level's below 5% positivity, you really can, you know, lift your lockdowns if it's been below 5% for 14 continuous days. Mm-hmm. And large numbers of states are well below that level. So positivity rate is really important to look at. Hospitalizations is very key. And excess mortality, the amount of mortality from all causes,
right,
over and above the five-year average. You know, when we know so little about the actual relationship between coronavirus and cause of death, looking at excess mortality. So when you look at that general picture, you do end up with a very different view than if you're just looking at daily case rate, which is what the media is hitting with us every night.
Indeed. All right. In part two, we're going to divide our podcast into two parts. We're going to take a deep dive into the issue of herd immunity. We're going to look at the upcoming vaccines, the progress is towards the vaccines, and, you know, a high degree of public distrust of the vaccines? Is it merited? Our guest is Dr. Robert Verkerk. Rob is the founder of A&H International, the Alliance for Natural Health, and he's been tracking this pandemic from his vantage point in the UK. We'll be right back with part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.